The start of the week and loads on the radio, climbing every mountain, reaching fitness goals and the importance of CPR in emergency situations. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran and here's what you might have missed.
You could see what happened to Christine. His life was saved by the careful, thoughtful experts who were there to help him. It was just wonderful to hear his recovery, knowing something can be done.
I let it take a lot of memories and a lot of times when I should have been out enjoying myself, I would have stayed at home and, you know, I wasn't able to bend down. I wasn't able to wear shoes with shoelaces and like even popping your bra on in the morning was an ordeal.
And only for dead bodyboards, there would have been 3 people being brought in drowned because I couldn't see how we could get back into land.
Well, there was a bit of a theme today on the radio. Lots of talk about conquering mountains and reaching fitness goals. So we'll start here on today with Damien O'Reilly and Tricia Lewis, author, wellness speaker and influencer. She's known for her Instagram account, Tricia's Transformation.
I started my weight loss journey, I think, for the millionth time in 2018. And I always felt that I would do a weight loss journey, I might lose 3 stone, and then I would kind of get kind of confident that I had it and slowly slip back into my old ways. So I decided in this journey, I was at 27 stone for a good year beforehand, and it was really, really a miserable time. It was really, really difficult, and I found my physical health and my mental health was down really, really bad. And I decided that this time I was going to document it for myself. And I did it on Instagram because I didn't really know many people on Instagram. And it kind of took off from there. But I think the reason why I said I was going to be honest from the start was because when I would lose the weight, I wanted to be able to look back and remember why I did this and what was my reason for doing this. And it was to feel better. And I suppose from there, I've been on the best kind of 3 years of my life because I figured out the most important thing of it all is looking after myself first, you know, and realizing that things will happen, things might go wrong, but that doesn't mean that I give up. So I suppose that's what I do on my Instagram daily. I document it and I love it. And I think that sometimes weight loss can be seen as a negative and nearly a punishment for the past, whereas I see every day as kind of nearly a gift to feel better. And every single day is a new day, and it's a second chance for me to kind of make things right again. And I love it.
And how, you don't mind me asking, how much weight have you lost?
So I've lost 7 stone 10. Now, last year I did struggle, 2000, when I worked in Jacobs on the Mall for 13 years and we were all left go on March the 15th, you know, for the foreseeable until everything went normal. And then I suppose I really struggled. I thought I was going to be fine. Like everybody, I was going to be overproductive. I was going to turn my home into a boot camp. And I really struggled because I found loneliness absolutely crippled me. But and I ended up gaining nearly 2 stone. But I've lost that now since January. But what I'd figured out in the middle of all of that was the issue was never the issue. My weight wasn't the issue. The issue was I wasn't able to handle loneliness and the isolation. And I ended up comfort eating. And, you know, and but from that, I found therapy. And I feel like, you know, once I don't give up every single kind of turn of my journey, I'm learning and I'm growing. And sometimes they're hard lessons. But then other times I'm like, oh, that was brilliant. That happened now.
And what is your target weight?
I would love to get to 12.5 stone. And I think the biggest lesson that I've learned is, you know, you never adjust the goal. You might have to adjust the time frame. And I want to do this in a sustainable way that I know that I'm okay at all times and I'm doing it right.
And what effect did being so heavy have on you mentally? And I suppose, not to intrude, but how do you get to such a weight, Tricia? I mean, when did it happen?
No, it's not intrusive.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those I feel like 14 to 20 stone would have took a bit of work. It would have took late nights. It would have took, you know, no rhythm in your food. And I suppose I was chefing and, you know, I would always kind of feed everybody first and then have something very late at night and no rhythm in my waking times. But I feel like, you know, then the 20 to 27 stone was like quicksand. And I felt that, you know, my range of motion, my mobility was kind of going downwards. And the effect that it kind of had on me was it was awful. I let it take a lot of memories and a lot of times when I should have been out enjoying myself, I would have stayed at home and, you know, I wasn't able to bend down. I wasn't able to wear shoes with shoelaces and like even popping your bra on in the morning was an ordeal. I had to think about it and always out of breath and I was a heavy smoker and it really, really was awful. And I suppose there was external demons, there was internal demons and it is really hard. And I suppose when it got so bad because by the time I went to kind of go fix it, it was very, very difficult. And I felt that I wasn't worthy, and I just didn't feel like a girl anymore, and I just felt like the biggest person in every single room, and I was constantly replaying this narrative over my head. And it was truly awful, and anybody who has weight will understand what I mean when you can hear your own internal thoughts louder than anyone telling you look fabulous. You can't hear that. And I suppose the longer you kind of do that yourself, the harder it is to get out of that kind of sadness.
And Tricia spoke about her family's attempts to support her through her change of lifestyle.
So it was an awful impact on my family. Like, I have 8 sisters, a mum and a dad, and we're very, very close. And they would have attempted so many times. They were everything, you know, was either tough love, nice love, gym love. They were trying and they were trying. And sometimes I would react perfectly, and other times then I would snap and kind of make it uncomfortable for them, because I suppose it was like pressing a wound with myself. Sometimes it hurt, and other times I needed comfort. And I think if anybody is suffering with weight now and someone does say it to you, try not to snap, because they're hurting too, and they're doing it out of love. That isn't hatred. And I suppose they would always try in different ways. And, you know, eventually I think they made the decision that, you know, pull back a little bit. They were more kind of worried about my mental health towards the end. But then they always tried to find a kind of little breakthrough or a little moment that they go, come here, we can have a chat about this. And they tried every single angle. But then I suppose you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You know, you have to do it for yourself. You have to realize, you have to put on your own life jacket, because so many people can guide you and you can talk about it, but you have a second chance. It is right now. Go and do it yourself, because nobody's doing that out of hatred. And just try and have compassion, because they're hurting too. And my family were terrified. They were absolutely terrified, like I was. But I suppose you think that they're not in pain. You know, you just don't see that. But they were.
And Trish, I know it's obvious that willpower, and maybe holding yourself as a hostage to fortune by, you know, sharing your journey with people online, you kind of get to a point where, you know, the point of no return on it, and you just have to proceed with your plan. But what physically were the other keys to losing weight? Because we all want to shed a few pounds, and we think that maybe eating and exercise are keys. But for you, what was it?
I think it's like, obviously eating less calories than you need, it will lose weight. I think lots of water. I think making sure you go to sleep early, like turn off Netflix, because you wouldn't leave the house with 10% battery. I think your mindset, I think you need to figure out, you know, are you doing this out of punishment? Are you doing this because you want to fit into a dress, or do you want to, you know, be healthy and have extra days in our lives, etc.? I think a big key indicator for me is not relying on motivation, because it's kind of like a gust of wind. It might come, it mightn't come. You're not guaranteed, but when it comes, it's like a bonus. I think discipline, and I also think realizing that failure is inevitable. And there's going to be a part in your life where you go, do you know what, I'm going to have the bag of chips. But the bag of chips is not the problem. We add too much emotion to it, and guilt and shame. At the end of the day, lads, it's only a bag of chips. It's get up in the morning and don't leave yesterday's decisions impact today. So I find that taking it day by day makes it so much easier, because it can be very daunting. If I have to think about, oh God, I've another 5.5 stone to go, that's going to take me forever, it's going to be upset. At the end of the day, not at all. I just work on today, whatever I can do today, I do it right and I do my best. And some days you have to park it and go, I am exhausted, I'm going to do it this way. But I think it's all about just kind of getting to know yourself and not copying anybody else, because I could follow the same plan as you, and Mary down the road could do the same plan, but we could all have different lifestyles and we're just setting each other up for fail. But I think just be positive about it and just go, I can do this, and I'll start small and I'll build onto it. Because I used to go head first into before and go, right, I'm sorted now. I'll never in my life have a potato. And you could find me 3 minutes later having 3 potatoes. And I'm like, well, I was restricted. You know, it's all about balance.
Yeah. Like, you sound so bubbly and confident and positive and all of that. But there is a vulnerability to you, as you said, and you saw therapy.
Yeah.
And I would have thought by, you know, sharing your weight loss program on social media was going to be a dangerous game to play, because we know how cruel people can be. But how hard has it been for you, or how easy has it been to have so many people looking on social media at you?
Well, it was never the plan day one, but it. I think everything happens for a reason. I absolutely love it. I think that I'm being very, very lucky with the amount of people that follow me and that are very, very kind. And every day I open my messages and I'm like, my Lord, it makes me realize that I need to be nicer. And but about everything, you might have lovely red shining apples, but there might be always one or two that might be a little bit negative or not understand it. But at the end of the day, my problem is my weight loss. It's not that. You know, if somebody might think that I might be too overweight and they might be bothered about the number of my scales, I can't change that. I can only look after myself. So is there negativity? A small bit, but it's like a ship. If you let the water into it, it'll sink. I don't leave it in. I just delete and move on and get over, because I have to. I have to do this for myself. And at the end of the day, I don't go to sleep at night thinking of other people's lives. And I have to. Like, you have to be very... You have to, I know the word is selfish, and I might say it's selfless. You have to look after yourself and go, okay, is this hurting me? Move on. And I think with social media, with anything you put up, if you put up weight loss, weight gain, anything, there will always be somebody who mightn't agree with it. But at the end of the day, I'm happy. And that's my end goal was happiness. And I'm getting there, and I'm just a bit of maintenance now. And I'm going to keep on getting smaller and smaller and bubblier and bubblier. I love it.
Well, the book is called Tricia's 21 Day Reset. That's Tricia Lewis from Today with Damien O'Reilly. Well, it was a shocking scene as Danish footballer Christian Eriksen collapsed and was treated on the pitch for a cardiac arrest at the Euros at the weekend. But it shone a light on the importance of quick response and access to defibrillators. For Morning Ireland, Gregory Leonard spoke about the death of his young son Francis whilst playing for a Finglas GAA team, Erin's Isle, at the age of 29.
Francis was a very keen sports person. He was very fit, playing senior football, and he had a great interest in his level of fitness. He was awarded his master's degree in November 2006. And a few days later, while playing football for Erin's Isle, died on the pitch. The opposition goalkeeper was a fully qualified physiotherapist, and another member performed CPR on Francis until the ambulance arrived. We had no defibrillator, and by the time, I suppose, the ambulance came, he could not be resuscitated. We, unfortunately, were in London at the time, and we heard the news and came home and arrived in Dublin that night and went out to Blanchardstown, and he was in the morgue. His manager was waiting there at midnight, Fergie Brown, and he helped us. Francis died on the pitch that day, but he got the best attention and all available care, and nothing else could have saved him except perhaps to have a defibrillator handy.
What lesson would you like people in general to take from the scenes they saw on Saturday and the very tragic scenarios that have happened to people like your son?
It's the CPR courses, it's the AED training, and we need more cardiologists. They are so dedicated, these men and women, to saving young, fit lives. You could see what happened to Christine. His life was saved by the careful, thoughtful experts who were there to help him. It was just wonderful to hear his recovery, knowing something can be done.
Gregory Leonard speaking about his son Francis this morning. Then Audrey Carville spoke to Dr. Catherine McGarrion, consultant cardiologist at the Mater Hospital.
Dr. McGarrion, thanks for taking our call. Shocking scenes, as I say, in Copenhagen. People just absolutely devastated witnessing what was taking place on the pitch. How common is the sudden death of young, fit, healthy people here?
Thanks very much for having me on. We know in Ireland that there are about 5,000 cardiac arrest events per year. We performed an audit back in 2005, 2007, and we found that in the age group 14 to 35, there were about 70 sudden cardiac arrests per year. I would say that about five of those were seen to occur during sports or training. So the majority of these events, although what we saw was absolutely shocking on Saturday night, most of these events do not occur in such public or during sporting activities. But still, you know, seeing such a devastating and shocking event, as Gregory tells us, really reminds us to put in place things like our defibrillators in our clubs to look after our heart health.
And in terms of the causes of what took place on Saturday, or indeed in the other cases that we hear about, is there some underlying weakness in the structure of a person's heart that they may be completely unaware of?
Oh, there can be. So, you know, we think about some of these high profile events that we've seen, Christian Eriksen on Saturday, people like Fabrice Muamba, Mark Vivian Foley. We, you know, in these events, we always look very closely to see what's the underlying cause. And it can be a predisposition towards a cardiac arrhythmia, such as a cardiac electrical condition, or sometimes it can be a muscle condition, an arrhythmogenic or an overgrown heart or an arrhythmic heart. So we look very carefully. And I suppose, you know, it's early days for somebody like Christian Eriksen. You know, his cardiologist will be looking into all of this for him.
And you say, obviously, that you don't have to be an athlete for it to happen. And indeed, you say most people are not. But does sport of any kind, particularly high intense sport, does that expose the damaged heart if it's there?
Yeah, you know, we think sport is such a positive in our community, and it is. And it, you know, provides so much physical health, heart health, mental health. The challenge is when people have a rare predisposing condition, it may be that high intensity or competitive sport isn't the right choice for them at that time, until they have, you know, seen and discussed it with their cardiologist and have all their sort of their treatments in place. And the challenge, of course, is knowing whether or not, you know, you need to have this sort of high intensity, highly specialized cardiology input. And for people, I suppose my message would be, the community prevention is so important. The CPR, the having the defibrillator, is so important. However, if you have a family history of a very sudden, unexpected cardiac arrest in a family member, or if yourself have been having unexplained collapses, then consulting with your primary care physician or consulting with one of the screening centres, such as the Family Heart Screening Clinic, the CRY Centre, the Irish Heart Foundation, would be a very appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, because when high-profile events like what happened on Saturday take place, you do hear calls for mass screening for those most at risk, particularly those who play sport. There is always that link in people's minds between the two. Is a mass screening programme like that feasible?
Feasible is a tough question. You know, some countries have implemented it, most famously Italy and then more recently Israel as well. And they did see a really impressive reduction in cardiac arrest, sudden cardiac death events in athletes. The challenge in Ireland, you know, I suppose it's been left a lot to the private sector, and they've done a good job. But there's definitely a debate to be had about who should be screened, when should we screen, how should we do that. It's a complex topic, but, you know, maybe this again is the wake-up call that we should start to look at that.
But certainly sports grounds, you would advise to have the defibrillator there in place.
You know, Irish sports grounds have taken this on. Individual clubs have taken this on. You know, I have to give acknowledgement to, you know, all our local clubs, our community first responders. We've seen a huge change in, you know, we have this audit that's gone through NUIG, the OCAR registry, and they have noticed a huge change in the amount of bystander CPR, AED usage.
Dr. Catherine McGarrian from Morning Ireland with Ortie Carville. Well, there was a bit of a theme today with hill and mountain climbing. Ryan was back from his travels and yes, he conquered that mountain.
The big thing that we spoke about before I left you, Zal, was Carrin Tuathail Mountain. I think that was the big one. I met a lovely couple on a walk not too long ago, and they said, "Did you do it?" And I said, "Well, you know something? I thought about it and I looked at the hill." I keep calling it the hill. Well, it is Carrin Tuathail Hill. And I thought, you know, I've kind of talked about it now, and the question is, you talk the talk, but do you walk the walk? Do you climb the climb? And I thought, you know what? I'll check it out. And this absolutely lovely family got in touch. Madeline and Morris got in touch on the radio and said, "We'll take you up the mountain and show you what it looks like, and, you know, we'll mind you." And they were just so lovely, I couldn't say no. And I went up Carrin Tuathail, and I came back down the bottom again, and it was an extraordinary experience. And I think the reaction I get from most people when they hear that I did it is, "What? You did it? Well, then anyone can do it. I mean, I can't believe you did it." And not only that, but I did it and came down and drove back to Dublin afterwards, which was probably an act of adrenaline fueled madness. But I'll say another thing is that I got home about 9:15, had a cup of tea, a biscuit, and went to bed. And I was telling the lads this morning, I said, I had the best sleep I've had since, I was going to say since COVID started. And then I realized, no, think about that sleep again, because I think about it a lot now. It's probably since I was born. It was that good. It was such a beautiful, I don't even know if I dreamt it. I don't care. I remember waking up going, what just happened? That was just beautiful. That sleep was, I mean, I don't know how you can like rave about a sleep, but it was like a 5-star review. It was the best sleep of all time. I mean, it was such a good sleep that I'd nearly go back up the mountain and come back down to have that sleep again. It was that good.
Wow, I'm sold. So later, Ryan welcomed Carl Henry into the studio, and this mountain climbing malarkey is all down to him.
Now, I didn't mention to people, but I'll tell them now, because off air, it was you who suggested when I was saying I was heading away because I was talking to you in a different world, and you said you should try to go climb Carrin Tuathail. Why would you say something like that to somebody like me?
Well, you made it sound so easy. I was listening before I came in. You're like, oh, you know, climbed Carrin Tuathail, came down, drove home, had an amazing sleep.
I did.
You know, people around the country who'd be raring to go. I suppose we were having a chat and I said, listen, well, you're down that neck of the woods. Why not try something totally random, totally crazy, but really phenomenal, for want of a better word? Because it's there. It's on our doorstep. We drive past these mountains all the time. We look at them and think, God, wouldn't it be great? You've done it and you did it. Now, it is important to tell people you do have to exercise to get fit to do it. Yes. You do have to get a guide, ensure all the safety protocols are there. But what an amazing feeling. And, you know, again, you made it sound very easy. It's 3,407 feet and 6 whole inches of height. You climbed it. And what comes from that is achievement and a sense of, can I do it? The nervousness build, particularly for yourself, because you publicly announced it.
Yeah, you know, that was my first mistake.
Can it be done?
Because I couldn't get out.
Am I setting myself up to fail? Or, you know.
Yeah.
And then when you conquer it, the feel-good kick from that, like you're a week later, you're still very high.
Still buzzing.
Over the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the beauty of it. And it's using your body, using your health to do things that are on our doorstep, that it's there. And so few people have climbed these mountains, and they are there. And the feeling from, whether it's the Sugarloaf, whether it's Carrin Tuathail, whether it doesn't matter, it's climbing the mountain, getting to the top, that sense of achievement and what that does for your overall health, your mental health, your physical health, your emotional health.
Yes.
It's transformative.
Yes.
And what happens then is you're like, right, where's the next one?
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in about an hour. But there is that. I was laughing earlier on about the metaphorical climb of the mountain. But there is something. Maybe it was after COVID and it was, you know, such a strain on people, including myself, you know, for different reasons. And you just think, God, you know, maybe I needed something as off the ball as this challenge. I don't know why. You think you'd had a challenge, you know, that things are the way they are. But I'm still not sure why I bothered my derriere to do it, but it felt very good, I'll be honest with you.
If nothing else, I think we've realised life is short. And what a tough. And I was out of Dublin for the first time at the weekend in ages. Yeah. And just driving on my own, you reflect on the 6 months, particularly that we've been through the winter lockdown. It's been so difficult.
Yeah.
Now is the time to get out, to get active. And Carrin Tuathail, you know, it's a euphemism. It's you know, that could be, for some people, it could be walking to the shop. It doesn't have to be the biggest mountain in Ireland. Yeah. Everyone has their own version of it.
Yes.
And that's, people listening in, that's the thing to take from it. It's the, can I do something, trying to work for that or train for that and then completing it.
Yeah.
And then you get into the cycle of health, because it's not boring anymore. It's fascinating because my body can do this. I'm able to do this. And you build upon it. And, you know, with gyms are back open, and it is important to set some targets and set some goals.
Yeah.
But, you know, work towards something. Use your bodies for what they can do, because they can do amazing things.
Being relatively fit helps, and you know, I did a bit, I keep an eye on myself in this regard. You know what I mean? So it's not just that I said I'll just lash up to the top of the mountain.
That is important,
and it really did help enormously. I think you're right. You can't just say, "Oh, did you just do that?" No, I mean, I would have been prepared for it physically.
Correct. Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing, right? So say if you are listening and you want to climb Carrin, great. You know, don't just rock up if you've been sitting on your bum for the last 12 months over COVID watching the box sets such as the US office. You got to exercise. You got to get fit to do it. and then get a guide. I know it's, you know, someone texted in, I think, earlier on, who said that the guide was going to, they booked a guide to bring you up. Do that.
Yeah.
It might cost you whatever the price is. It'll cost you less than a night out, less than a meal out. And they'll give you the, not just the safety element, but the stories and the history and the sense of romance from that comes from climbing things like
that.
That's
these, a great, you know? Romance is a good word too, because it is so rugged and beautiful. And now we got up and it was cloudy. It was really, really wet, and it was not that it wasn't nice. The conditions weren't friendly. They were inclement conditions. But that added to it, like that challenge, and you knew that you were, the rain was hitting your face like you were being punched. And I just thought, that's what it's all about.
There's something about, you know, human versus nature. And it's lovely, and I love exercising, and I would say that I'm the trainer guy, but I love exercising when the weather is really bad. You know, safety is important, and I know the areas that I'll exercise in, but there is that sense of, everything's against me here. Can I do this? And can I conquer it? And that applies to any form of exercise, whether it's weight loss, whether it's going for a walk, if you're very sedentary, whether it's building up your fitness for a 5K, whether it's climbing a mountain. It's the same sense of, can I do it? And the self-belief, I can do something.
And Madeline Walsh from Mountain Adventure Walks was Ryan's guide up the mountain. They met at Fawcett Church, where Ryan was all geared up.
I think the nicest thing was that you looked at me in my jeans and shirt and trousers or whatever shoes I was wearing. You thought, certainly your dad thought, and where's the gear? I said, is this tote not enough? I mean, there was laughter, there was mockery in the air, but you very kindly reached into the boot and took out everything I needed and said, there's a church there, there's a loo there, get changed. And, you know, were you worried by the sight of me that morning, Madeline?
I wasn't worried, no. You may have been a little bit unprepared, but we had everything for you. So in regards to fitness, and you mentioned that you do a lot of walking, that I'm sure there was no problem.
Yeah, and then what about the weather? I know that your dad was in two minds the night before regarding the conditions or whatever. When we got up then and hit the clouds and the temperature dropped, and I'll never forget when we got to the top, the sandwiches that you were very kindly were bringing out, and the bread was dribbling down my knuckles as the rain punched it out of my hand. I mean, were you worried about that?
So there was very strong winds and heavy rain when we got to the top, and it was challenging on the way up as well, but you fully embraced the elements when you were going up. But on the way down, it is very important to gauge the weather, and that way then when you have a guide and you're navigating, it is, you know when to lay low and you know when to actually move on. And then when the clouds come down and things like that, it's very important as well to make sure that you don't travel the wrong route. But I think you did really well with the soggy sandwiches at the top as well.
Do you remember your dad was skipping down over those steps, that scree or whatever it's called, at one stage, and I was trying to follow him. And we were bouncing, you know, like...
The Fred Astaire walk.
The Fred Astaire. That's why I said your dad looked like Fred Astaire, trying to kind of negotiate that. That was one of the most amazing sights I've seen. He was trying to overtake another party at that point. He's quite agile, isn't he?
Dad, he is fit as a fiddle.
Really is.
He is.
And what was one of the nice things about the trip up, because it was just the three of us, was it felt like... I've never done the Camino. But it felt like a kind of the Camino of Karen Tuchel, you know, where the conversation went all over the place in a really interesting way. And, you know, I felt we definitely got on very well. Well, I would say that anyway. But there was a good vibe and, you know, it was intriguing.
It was. It really ebbed and flowed. There was music, there was stories, there was
chocolate,
mythology. There was, you know, when we're going up to the three tiers, and then we had like, we always call it the breakfast table, where we stop and we have a little break. And then that's before we head up Brother O'Shea's Gully. But it was a very intriguing day. It was like everything just flowed nicely.
Yeah. And when you pushed me into the car and said, get out, and get out of Killarney, get out of Kerry, were you glad to see the back of me?
No, I'd love to get out. It's actually embrace Karen Tuchel on a sunny day.
And Carl Henry had some advice for heading up that mountain.
I think people can do anything that they set their mind to. I suppose what I do for a living, I help people achieve those dreams and goals for things. The key thing, obviously, is safety, but it's about setting a target, setting a goal. Look around you. Like, exercise doesn't have to be boring. It's not the same old stuff anymore. Like, we've got amazing mountain biking trails. I was surfing down in Inchidani on Thursday. There's all the hill walking trails. Like, everything, it's on your doorstep. Look around you.
Yeah.
And take from that, when we were sitting at home in January and February, locked in, dreaming of doing wonderful things, those wonderful things are there. So set that target. Work towards it. If you need help, go and get it. Again, ask around locally, depending on what that goal may be. And then safety is really important. So, like, you know, mountaineering.ie is a really good website. If it's water safety, if you're, you know, cold water swimming or anything like that, watersafety.ie. Get the safety advice and then get the expertise. For, you know, mountains, getting a guide like, you know, you did then in Kerry, perfect.
Yeah.
Because it, and as I said, you know, it's not, it's have, you can hear it in the chatting to Madeline there, it's having the crack.
Yes.
You had the crack, you had an experience. It wasn't just the mountain, it was the chats, the conversation, the food, the stories. And I use the word romantic. It's a romantic mindfulness moment because you don't think about anything else.
No,
you
no.
Just look around you. You take it in, and that's a very, it's very powerful to experience that.
There were times, Madeline, the only thing I was thinking about was staying alive, which just don't die,
Madeline. Were there any really scary moments? That's what we all really want to know here. It all sounds very, very poetic. Fill us in on all the juicy gossip.
Well, there is always places where you have to scramble and be completely mindful, like, you know. The saying is like the body needs movement and the mind needs stillness, and nature gives that to you. So there's parts where you are focused on every step and every handhold on the way down and all the way up. Like coming down the Heavenly Gates, there's a section where you just turn into the wall and you come down safely. But like that, it's about just being mindful and being careful of the weather as well as every step you take.
Madeline Walsh and Carol Henry on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And later, Evelyn O'Rourke was also climbing up hills, this time at night, and she wasn't taking any chances with the weather.
Well, the main plan for me was that it was a dry evening, and boy, could I've got a better weekend. I was so lucky that worked out for so well. But the way it starts is that you meet up in the car park at the back of the visitor centre around there at Glendalough at around 7 o'clock, and you're told that it'll run until about midnight. And of course, you pack good walking shoes or your sturdy runners, a rain jacket. It was funny, the list, it said, you know, bring warm clothes or whatever. You basically have to dress like an onion, so you're peeling the layers on and off. But possibly the snacks, but possibly the most important thing you bring is your head torch. And it's all organised by a man called Mark Kill. Now, Mark has set up this new business called wildsummits.ie. He was laughing, telling me he set it up in January 2020, which was maybe a little bit an unfortunate time to set up a business. But he's flying now, and he's offering a wide range of outdoor experiences. He does things like night camping to rock climbing in Waterford and in Wicklow. But this one, the Glendalough Night Hike, I just kind of liked this one. And the way it works, Damien, really, is that you see Glendalough, which so many of us know so well and love so much, but you see it turning from day into night. So you see this beautiful, stunning scenery, you know, turning and the light kind of fading away. It's absolutely beautiful. And you see stunning nature along the way, but you're guided around it, which is the key thing. Because most of us, you know, muddle our way up and that's fine. But to have two expert guides is such a joy, you know. So a group of around 15 of us went on this hike. And here we're going to start with listening to Mark, who's told me a little bit more about the plan for the night. And then we'll hear some of the walkers that I met up with talking about their reasons for going on this adventure.
Hi, my name is Mark Kyo, and I am the owner of Wild Summits, an outdoor adventure tour company operating in both the Wicklow Mountains and the Cumara Mountains.
So Mark, it's a beautiful evening. I mean, we're blessed with the weather we've been given this evening. But just in terms of the night hike, you know, what is the plan? Where did it come from as an idea?
The idea came from myself when I was training for my mountain leader, and I really enjoyed going out at night. Really, all my ideas that I've brought to the business, they've all come from what I've enjoyed personally during my time training as a mountain leader, training as a climbing instructor, and then trying to package that and offer that to the general public as well, and to give people those unique experiences.
Describe the attraction of walking and hiking at night. Like, what is different about it for you?
Different world opens up at night, so there's a different element to the wildlife. So you have the bats come out, more minute wildlife like the shrews come out, deer. Once all of the people leave the trail, they like to come out. So last night we saw a couple of stags as well. You're under the night sky, there's stargazing going on, the sun sets, you're catching up while you're on the ridge. It's just a different way to explore and to view the landscape in a different way than what we're used to, really.
Maura, Deirdre,
Jenna.
Why are you here? Why did you decide to come here?
Someone I follow on Instagram did this probably about a month ago, so I just reached out to them to just see what it was. Sounded like something different, something nice, get out with the gang.
It's real post-COVID, isn't it? Just to get out.
I don't know that I would have done it before, but I'm kind of looking for anything that gets me out of the house and something different to my four walls. So yes, here I am.
Okay, so you brought some pals with you.
I was roped into it. I know, I love hiking as well. I do it a lot myself, but it was nice for the three of us to be able to go along and pack our treats and have our little evening out.
It's like a real bit of an adventure, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And we don't get to meet that often. This was kind of a little activity for all of us to do something together.
It just sounded like something different, and we do different walks and kind of hikes around Dublin, but this seemed like something that was taking it to the next level, and obviously it's going to be pitch black, which seems a bit mad. We're kind of half terrified, half excited.
And Evelyn was talking about her two expert guides on the night.
And the way they work at Damien, very clever, is that one of them's at the front all the time and one of them's at the back. So you're all the time kind of sandwiched between the two of them. And there's great chats. You know, they want it to be fun and informative, but they're happy to answer questions as you go along. And it's such a stunning setting. I mean, the evening I was there was just beautiful. It was such a pleasure to be there, just wandering along, listening to fascinating facts and hearing all about the background to the park. And we have some lovely stuff from social media up on our Twitter feed on my Instagram feed, Evelyn RTE, just photographs of people and little videos that people might want to look at just to get a sense of it. But here you're going to hear the two guides introducing us to the evening's plan, and then we'll get more of a flavour of them in action. And again, Damien, speaking to people like the women I spoke to there, the appeal of getting out into nature after months and months of lockdown was mentioned so often. And the guides themselves, of course, believe that the power of nature has really been reinforced for all of us during the pandemic.
We have everybody here, I think. Yeah, excellent. So hello, everybody. My name is Patrick. I'll be one of your guides here tonight. This is Dave here as well.
Hi, everyone.
I hope you enjoy your night tonight. I'm sure you will. So we're going to be covering about 13 kilometers here tonight. Don't worry. I can see a bit of panic in some eyes setting in there. We will be stopping periodically. As your guides, we'll be stopping to just explain a bit about what we're seeing around us, a bit about the human history. I'll be delving a lot into the natural history, but we will also stop for sit-down breaks as well. We'll get you around in one piece, don't worry. And as Mark said, we haven't had anybody fail just yet, so we won't have it this group either, I'm sure. So is everybody happy to go? We just have one last kind of look at your equipment. Everybody's confident in their boots. You have spare water, some food, extra layers. Just be like an onion up on the hills tonight. Extra layers. Okay?
Just take note of the trees we're travelling under as we head to the lake.
All right, folks, just do me a favour, and before we leave, I'd like you to turn around and look down the valley there. If you look down the valley, you can see the absolute beauty and the glory of nature down there. At the top of the hill on the left-hand side, you can see a trackway just coming out of the trees. In a couple of hours, we're going to be up on top there. And when we get there, I'm going to tell you how the Irish saved civilization.
One of the things that people keep saying to me, you know, one of the reasons they're doing this walk is COVID. They just feel they need that mood lifter. What is it about nature and these kind of walks that's so appealing to us all?
Well, humans evolved over thousands of years, and for most of that time we lived outside. So if we developed and evolved in nature and we've moved away from it, to come back out into nature is to reconnect with your part of nature. So during my studies, I looked into a bit of the psychology of being outdoors, studied the effect on people of going into nature. Just spending time in a forest alleviated people's mood and made them feel better. It absolutely has that transformative effect. You'll really notice if you come out for a walk in a wild place, you know, your lungs open up, you forget your worries, your mind opens up, and you can forget everything and just enjoy being out here. It's great.
So that's Dave and Patrick there. Now, it takes 5 hours, Evelyn. You want to be fit now, would you?
It's funny, I was trying to think about this, how I'd best describe it. I mean, they describe it as moderate and toughness. Look, you'd certainly need to be able to complete a good walk. We did around 14Ks, the lad said there. You do stop and start. They pace it so, so well. I mean, you know, it was hot, so every so often you're like, oh my God, I'm about to collapse. And then you'd stop, have your water, and they'd chat away to you. And being with the group is great because it also keeps you moving. But the way can be steep at times going up, but you know, you're certainly not looking glamorous by the top of it. It was hot, as I said. But if you could do something like the Sugarloaf, for example, you'll be absolutely grand doing this. And the scenery is so spectacular that you're constantly distracted by it. And when it turns from sunset to the dark and you get to switch on the head torches and make your way down the path with this group, there's something really magical about that. So I really would encourage people to maybe push themselves to try and think about it.
Yeah, I might just dust off those hiking boots. It sounds great. That's Evelyn O'Rourke's report from today with Damien O'Reilly. And Katie Hannon was in for Joe in the afternoon on the live line, and she was talking to a clearly still shocked Paul Dwyer.
It was a great weekend weather-wise for the last few days, and a lot of people headed to beaches, headed to waterways, jumped into the water, which was great, but you do have to be careful. Paul O'Dwyer, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Yeah, how are you, Paul? Because you had a very traumatic day yesterday.
It was very, very traumatic. To be honest, a bit emotional and very tired. I didn't sleep much last night.
Take us back. You were on Bunmahan Beach in Waterford.
That's right. Yeah, I was down there with my family. And then later on the day, my brother and mother turned up as well. So we're just enjoying ourselves on the beach and the paddling. I was out paddling with my son in the water. We were just kind of crashing into the waves. And I just heard a young fella crying out for help. So I just went straight out to help him.
And was this a very young child?
He was around 10, I imagine. There was two children. There was a boy and a girl.
Okay. And were they both in trouble, do you think?
Oh, don't worry. Yeah, they're out of their depth, completely sure. When I got out there, I was completely out of my depth as well. So.
Okay, so you swam out to help. What happened then?
Well, I swam out. I got out quite quickly out to him. And I had to make a decision which child to go to. So I went to the child that was nearest to me, and he was the one who was crying out for help. So it was a tough call now, to be honest. When I was trying to help that poor chap, I was just thinking about the poor girl the whole time on her own. It wasn't nice.
Yeah, that's Sophie's Choice, like the classic Sophie's Choice. But were you able to grab onto the boy?
Yes, I tried to explain to him I was going to kind of put him on his back, and I was going to try to pull him in, and then I was going to go back out for the girl. But sure, we were getting nowhere. We were just basically staying in the one spot. The tide was pulling us out.
And what state was he in at that stage?
I'm not sure. He was very traumatised. He was very scared, and which I can understand completely. He just went into survivor mode. Like he panicked. Sure, we were all panicking, and he just climbed on my back, and he was trying to stay up that way. But he was trying to keep him to stay on his back rather, because he was dragging me down, and he was going down, and sure, I couldn't touch the bottom at any stage. So I got back up, and I just tried to do the same thing again with him and push him along. And then I got to a stage where I could touch my toes off the bottom. And I told him that I would lift him up in the air and throw him forward, and I keep doing that until we get in land. So that's what I did. I threw him forward and I swam to him again, and sure, I went to throw him again, and I couldn't find my feet on the bottom at all. So we were struggling again at that stage. And luckily enough, my brother came out. My wife seen what was happening from the beach, and he ran out to help. And basically he came at the very right moment, because I was exhausted at that stage, and so was the poor chap. And God only knows what the little girl was, how she was. I don't know how she stayed up.
And they were able to pick up the little girl?
Well, luckily enough, my nephew was on a bodyboard. He was out in the water with his mother, and she told him to go out and try help. And only for the dead bodyboards, there would have been three people being brought in drowned, because I couldn't see how he could get back into land or just getting sucked out.
God, that's just terrifying. And what age was your nephew?
Oh, he's only 10 years of age. He was very brave. Danny's his name. He was very brave, only for him and his mother. I don't know if any of us would have gotten back in, because it just didn't seem to be any hope. People were trying to come out to help us, but they weren't able to get out. It was scary, very scary.
So scary. And Paul says it just happened so fast.
It happened so fast, and there's even people around us that just didn't know what was going on. They didn't think, it was hard to alert anybody or get any help, because the noise of the water and the waves are choppy. It was tough going.
Was there many people in the water at that stage?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, there was loads of people in the water. See, we're so far out, but if you looked across level, 50 metres away, it was only up to people's waist. But we were as well over our heads.
And were all those other people totally oblivious to what was happening with you and with these children?
Yeah, sure. They just didn't hear us or see us.
God, you were lucky, weren't you, that your own family spotted what was going on?
Yeah, I was lucky. My wife, now she's seen that I was swimming out to her child, and then she kind of noticed that my head was going under and that child's head was going under, and I was lucky Connor was brave enough to come out.
And that 10-year-old Danny, that's amazing that he had the presence of mind to keep it together and come out.
He was unbelievable, yeah. Funny for him, we wouldn't have come back in. Him and Julie, so, and Connor.
And Julie is another...
Julie is Danny's mother, yes. Danny's sister-in-law. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you were spent, you were hanging on to the ball, and it was Julie actually that made it out again with a bodyboard to bring you back in.
I wouldn't have made it back in by myself at that stage. I was so exhausted. So lucky Julie came out to me. And we just floated in the water for ages. We just said we stay until somebody comes to rescue us. We were in no panic. We weren't worried at that stage because Connor was bringing in the kids, and I don't know how he actually got them in, because it was the current was just sucking us out, you know. So we just said we'd stay. But then a swimmer, one of the sea swimmers came by. He helped us back in with another man. I don't know his name. He came in from the shore, and we all kicked our way back in. So.
And would you be a decent swimmer, Paul?
I'd hold me on, yeah. I'd hold me on, yeah.
And this time, like, was it a riptide? Like, it just seems to have been extraordinary that people a few feet away were fine, and this was pulling you out at this speed.
Pulling us out, yeah. And it was at the stage where the tide was starting to turn. Say, if it could have been 10, 15 minutes later, we could probably go to get back in no bother, you know? It's hard to know. I don't know the waters, so it's not my... I don't know.
And would you swim there often? This Bunmanan Beach? No.
We'd normally go to either Woodstown or Dunmarys. We just went that day because the kids liked the waves, and we said we'd bring the bodyboards. So something different.
Yeah. God, it was something different. All right. That's some tale, Paul.
It is, considering the fact that there's hundreds upon hundreds of people on the beach and there wasn't any lifeguards on duty. It just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, we
like they're on duty in Dunmarys and Tramore, so why couldn't Bunman have theirs on duty?
Now, I know our producer actually looked into this, and we're told that a lifeguard service is provided at Ardmore, Bunmahan, Clonee, Dunmore East and Tramore, that cover is generally provided, it says here, at weekends in June and daily from July and August, but see local signs for details. But you're saying there you didn't see any lifeguards yesterday?
There's no lifeguards, and there's no flags up. You know the way you normally know, stay within the flags, etc. That wasn't there. There's nobody there.
And was there signs for you saying that no flags up? But were there any signs indicating that it was dangerous to swim there, or that there were dangerous currents there?
No, I didn't see any anyway. They weren't obvious to me. So,
you sound fairly shook after it, Paul.
I was now, yeah. I'm just thinking about it since last night, you know. It's hard to get out of head how I could have done things differently. Should have called people at the very beginning, you know. And then that poor little girl, leaving her on her own, like, that was tough.
Yeah, that would play on your mind. You didn't know those children, though, did you? They were strangers.
No, I didn't know them at all. Strangers, yeah.
And did you meet their parents when you came out?
I didn't, because I was a few minutes later getting out, and I went straight over to Connor. He was laying on the sand. The scene was, "You okay?" And so by then it was kind of after separating the whole thing.
God, I mean,
I didn't get to see him.
They owe you a huge debt, Paul, because you know, God only knows if you hadn't seen them or heard that little boy calling out at that moment.
Yes, I know, but sure, in one way, you'd be always thinking, could I do more, you know? But I was just lucky that Julie and Danny and Connor came out. And they were lucky too. So.
Well, that's Paul there. And later, Gareth called Katie with his rescue story.
Well, it was in Morris Castle Strand. I was in the water with my 10-year-old and my 3.5-year-old.
Where is Morris Castle?
Morris Castle Strand. It's Kilmuckridge.
All right.
And the beach was fantastic. The weather was great. There were lifeguards on the beach. We were standing out playing. I was 4 or 5 steps into the sea only, with my 3.5-year-old, and my 10-year-old was further out. I turned around, just there was no reason to turn around, but I turned around to look back, and about 15 meters onto the beach, I saw this woman with the fear of God in her jump up and start to run, and like there was the fright in her face, you could see. And I just looked down to my left, and her, I'd say it was about an 18-month-old child, who just was lying in the water, drowning.
Oh, my God.
So I literally, it was incredible. I just, and you could see by the little fella, right, this was only, I'd say it was about a foot of water, maybe say a foot and a half of water would have been only, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just would have been a little bit over my knees maybe kind of thing, so not even a foot and a half. But the little guy was on his back sinking, bless him. So I just leaned down and grabbed him and picked him up. And then the mother arrived within, maybe 2 seconds, whatever the time was. It went very quickly. But it's incredible how quickly it can happen anywhere, even with lifeguards, and never mind riptides. It's kids like, when they fall over like that, like, you have to be closer to the beach, you know?
It is seconds.
And, like, the outcome of that could have been very different if we didn't turn around and look, because we didn't see that little guy. We did not see him, and we were standing right beside him. We didn't see him. We just saw the fear on the woman's face running towards the sea. That was it.
Yeah, so you heard nothing. Nobody else noticed it.
No one else. No, he was beside me. The kid was, I'd say, couldn't have been 2 feet from me. He couldn't have been.
Well, and you wouldn't have noticed, as you say, if you didn't see his mother.
But I didn't, Katie. Didn't see him. I didn't see the kid until I saw her, and you could see my God. You could see, you know, when you see someone's face, you could see there's something happening here. Good God.
And the child, once you plucked him out of the water, was he okay immediately?
He didn't need to be resuscitated, but he was gurgling. He had taken on some water. He had, because he was sinking backwards. So like he was underwater, the child was, and sinking backwards. So, and the fear I had was because like the sea, the Irish Sea, you can't see straight through it. Like obviously, if she had got there 2 seconds later, would she have known exactly where he was? You know, that kind of way, because you couldn't see into.
Of course, yeah.
So it was, you have to be closer to the beach. Like if you have someone, a little fella or a little girl in there that can, that the slightest of waves can just tip them over, or they can just trip and fall anyway. It doesn't even have to be a wave, you know. You have to be standing beside them.
It's so easy though, and I mean, I don't want to be in any way judgmental about anyone. It's so easy to take your eye, you know, get distracted for a minute or half a minute.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in a beach situation, that can be all that it takes. But it can be so, you know, it's just so easy to happen.
And a lifeguard's no good to you at that point, because the kid disappears in a second, you know?
Yeah.
They can't keep their eyes on everything. Like, I know my little boy told them in the class in school the following day that we saved someone. But the thing is, though, like, I think she saved them when you think of it, because I didn't see him, you know. But the fear on that woman running down, she should have screamed as well, because then more people would have seen it, you know.
Yeah.
But if we didn't see her, if we didn't see the fear in her face, that outcome would have been different.
Yeah. And how are you yourself after it?
It was funny. I didn't flinch over it. And I tell you why, because I could see she was so panicked, right? I dumbed it right down for her because the mother was so panicked. I was just thinking, oh no, sure, he just tripped, he was fine. So I really made very, very light of it there and then for her. We made really light of it because you could see, like, bless her, she was very upset. So you didn't want to you didn't make any big deal whatsoever of it, right? So I just said, nah, she just tripped. I didn't see at all what happened, to be honest. I just saw her face and saw him under the water. But I just said, ah, no, he just tripped. He was grand, like, you know.
Yeah.
That's Gareth on the live line with Katie Hannon. Now, the National Museum of Time opened in Waterford and Conor Kane was taking a look.
You're happy enough with that?
Oh, yes.
So we'd sign off on that.
But here is good.
David Bowles and Coleman Curran are collectors of clocks and watches, experts on the study of time and how timepieces work. It's been a passion for decades, as David Bowles explains.
I started very young. At about 15 years of age, my father had a slight interest in clocks and I became fascinated by them. And I was really very lucky because at an early stage, I discovered that Irish clocks were, nobody was interested in them. They were very well made, they were very interesting, And I was able to pick up wonderful examples in Ireland and England from that age onwards, in my 20s, at trivial prices by today's standards. There's no competition. It's the right way to have the scene.
But now, after years of collecting, attending auctions and fairs, often at the same time, but sometimes unknown to each other, they're giving it all away. The National Museum of Time, opening later today in Waterford, is the result of a collaboration between the two, according to Coleman Curran.
Both David and myself have been collectors for many, many years, particularly of Irish clocks, so we decided that it would be great if we could assemble both of our collections and put them together and put them on display, because ultimately it's very difficult to see this number of particularly Irish clocks all in the one place. So it's been a very interesting collaboration, and it's wonderful to see it coming to fruition after about 6 years. It was a long road, but here we are.
Occupying an old church building in Greyfriars, the new museum is another feather in Waterford's cultural cap, as director Eamon McEnany explains.
Absolutely superb world-class collections, as are the clocks themselves. And I suppose from the point of view of a museum and why we were interested in it, we feel this is a museum for everybody. You know, young people are really into technology nowadays, and even more so, I suppose, because of COVID. They're stuck in their bedrooms. But like, when we think of it, these were the early computers of their day, and people were interested in astrology in those days and want to know what, you know, how do you exactly figure out time, and it's a great science, and there are a lot of scientific instruments here as well. But I think it'll interest, you know, all age groups really, from the people who are really into horology and want to know exactly what's in the clocks and how one is different from another, and the people who just want to know how clocks work and again from the other stage, just the fashion of clocks, but the whole idea that these are the computers of their day.
On show are hundreds of Irish and European timepieces, and even a 130-year-old music box. The museum is already a source of some pride, as the keeper of Waterford Treasures, our curator, Rosemary Ryan, points out.
It is the finest collection of Irish-made clocks and watches in the world. It also contains very significant European pieces. It just goes from the earliest pieces, about 1560, and it goes right up to the present day with clock and watchmaking. It's quite a coup for Waterford, really, to have acquired this collection and this museum. We're very excited. It's really quite a red letter day.
The donations of hundreds of pieces are generous, but will the collectors miss having such unique pieces around their homes? Here's Coleman.
No, because I'm happy that they are coming to a place where they can be enjoyed. The integrity of them is maintained here, and they can be enjoyed by people in Ireland, and they can be the progression of them can be seen. The social history can be examined. The beautiful cabinet making can be examined. And the engineering, it's all terribly interesting.
And David agrees.
Well, there were here, there and everywhere, storage in the attic and so on. And I won't miss them. I'll be delighted to see them in a very good home where other people can appreciate them.
Conor Kane's report for Morning Ireland. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.